We study billionaires, and this is episode 43 of the Investors Podcast.
Broadcasting from Bel Air, Maryland, this is the Investors Podcast. They'll read the books and summarize the lessons. They'll test the waters and tell you when it's cold. They'll give you actionable investing strategies. Your host, Preston Pish and Stig Broderson.
All right, how's everybody doing out there? This is Preston Pish, and I'm your host for the Investors Podcast. And as usual, I'm accompanied by my co-host, Stig Broderson, out in Denmark. And today, I'm actually accompanied by a whole lot more people than just Stig. I'm looking at Colin Yablonsky. I'm looking at Hari Ramachandra. And I'm also looking at Toby Carlisle, because we have formed our mastermind group for the second quarter of 2015. And we're going to be talking about all those topics that everybody wants to discuss out there. And just kind of looking at the direction that the market's going here in the future. So I want everybody to know you got the insider conversation that we're having with our own mastermind group and how we're preparing for the future with the financial markets. What do you guys think about oil? Let's talk about that. Where do you guys see that? I'm really kind of looking at you, Colin, because you're so close to that area and it's really kind of intimate to your region. But what's the word up there? What are people saying?
People are nervous right now, to be completely honest. A lot of companies have been laying off employees, major companies, major organizations that are involved in the oil and gas industry, in the oil sands development, in other resource companies. And I think it's starting to slowly trickle down to other elements of the market, like I talked about with real estate, where you're starting to see home prices drop month over month. Listings are increasing dramatically. The luxury market is getting absolutely crushed in Calgary right now, where any homes that are priced above $1 million, they're just sitting there, and they've been sitting there for months. So it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next, 3 months, because we've gone through this full cycle in Canada where about 9 months after you see the drop in oil, typically it starts to trickle down to people losing their jobs, real estate prices dropping and so forth. So it'll be interesting to see. And Stig, I saw that you had something there.
Yeah. So I don't know if this is good news for the community in Calgary, but I'm definitely bull on oil. And I know that this might seem completely contradictory, that since we are hearing that we have a new world order, the game is changing when it comes to oil. OPEC has just let loose, and there was all these good arguments why oil prices won't rebound. But I just think that we need to remember that oil, that's just a commodities business. So you can compare this to something like the insurance business, or you can compare it to other kinds of commodity, where there is actually a somewhat low barrier of entry. I mean, yes, it depends on how you define the oil market, but there's actually a very low barrier entry because it's a homogeneous product. So you will see, in general, a very steady demand. The demand for oil is steadily increasing by just about 1%, have been that for a long, long time. But then you will see that the supply really keeps fluctuating. And now you're seeing a downturn in that. Preston, I see you have something.
So I guess I have the opposite perspective on this one from you. And I think Toby, if I remember right, Toby, you've been buying into a little bit of oil as it's been getting hit, correct?
The energy companies, not the commodity.
Okay, so you've been buying into the companies a little bit. Now, this is my concern with oil moving forward. I think in the short term, maybe like in the next 6 months, you might see the price on the barrel of oil kind of rebound. But here's my concern and why I think Buffett sold out of his big Exxon position is because I think that if you're a company that is very heavy on tangible assets, I think you're going to get your lunch eaten over the next decade. Simply because of the fact that inflation, I think, is going to have some real effects on those types of businesses with their capital expenditures. So that's why I think that's why he sold out of that position. I could be wrong. It could be something else. But that's why I'm a little hesitant looking at it from a long term investment standpoint, why I'm a little hesitant to get back into the oil businesses. Toby, I want to hear what you got to say.
The oil companies are having to do increasingly heroic things to find oil. So oil sands wasn't economical for a long period of time because the price of oil was simply too low and it costs more to get the oil out of the sands. Similarly, for the offshore oil drilling, they have to go increasingly further offshore and deeper to find those big oil fields, which are expensive to do. Just on the price of oil, so the best guess if you're trying to price out a commodity for the price of that commodity in 12 months, and it doesn't really matter what it is. The best guess is always the current price. And the reason is, it's not that it's likely to be where it is in 12 months' time. It's that it's so unpredictable, up or down, that you minimize your error by guessing or by putting into your model the current price. What interesting thing with oil, I saw some research just this week by a fund manager who I know in Australia, who was a university lecturer while I was there. He's an econometrician, Dr. Chris Leidner. He's looked at the price of oil and said, typically that is the case. The best guess for the price of oil 12 months hence is where it currently is, for the simple fact that it minimizes your error. But when oil drops precipitously like this, and it happens so infrequently, that you can find that there's a reasonable chance that it does rebound and it's considerably higher 12 months from now. And I think he said the margin is something like 40 to 70% higher from the low.
Yeah, you know, I think this is as it is with all commodities, this is really a marginal cost perspective. So, and you know, so in the long term, you will just see that, like, the profit, that's simply the adaption between the marginal cost and the marginal revenue. And you will see that you will have, like, an increasing demand of oil, but even a steady demand of oil. And then you will see how the marginal cost for the different companies just adapt to that. And then you will see, for instance, with Toby's talking about, you know, oil sand, and you were talking about that, what's the marginal cost of developing fracking. And then gradually you will see that the oil price just adapt to that. And I think that's something a lot of people are missing, because they're saying we have too much supply. Yes, that's true. But what happens when you have too much supply? Then you will have people going out of the market, and that would change the cost structure.
Kristen, I just wanted to chime in on your thoughts on why Buffett and Munger sold off from ExxonMobil. Interestingly, somebody asked the same question in this year's annual meeting at Omaha. And Munger's answer was very interesting. Buffett actually kind of evaded answering this question. He just passed the buck to Munger. And Munger in his usual form, said, well, it's better than holding cash. And he saw it as a safe alternative place to put his cash, which is waiting for deployment. And that's what he said. And that was a very interesting answer.
So, and he basically said he'd rather hold cash than to continue holding those companies.
No, it's the other way around. He said he wanted to park his cash somewhere, and he chose ExxonMobil for that.
Yeah, and they sold out of that position in, what was it, January?
Yes. And they didn't really talk about why they sold off, but the inference that at least I made from his answer was that they found something else. And it might be the deal that they recently struck with the 3G folks acquiring Kraft. So maybe there is some cash requirements there.
It was just an opportunity cost type deal where they felt like they could get a better deal with the 3G, then that's why they moved out of it. So it wasn't like they disliked it. They just found like they had found something that was more valuable.
Exactly. It's definitely like I have been following Buffett's oil bets. And when he bought into ConocoPhillips in 2009 or 2010 and then sold it off, it was a clear loss. They lost a lot of money on that investment. Whereas, correct me if I'm wrong, on ExxonMobil, I don't think they lost much money. They pretty much got their money back. So that's kind of the answer, at least I heard in the talk. But however, I liked Toby's description. Essentially, what Toby summarized was that oil industry is a negative feedback loop. Toby, correct me if I'm wrong. The way I see it as a negative feedback loop is, if the oil prices goes higher, then all these marginal costs that some of the hard to find oil incurs will become justifiable at that price, 100 and above or 80 and above. But as the oil price goes down, all these marginal players like the oil sands, the frackers, all these folks become less economical at that point of time. And as we can see in the recent past, the rig counts have been coming down drastically, which will impact the supply.
I think it was Stig talking about marginal prices, but I agree with Stig. So I just shamelessly, I'm going to plug my website right now. So I have this website called Acquirers Multiple, which looks at all the companies listed in the US and examines them on the basis of this acquirer's multiple, which looks for cash-rich balance sheets and strong operating earnings, etc. If I run my model now, and you can see this on the side in the large caps, of the top five cheapest large capitalization companies in the States at the moment, four of them are oil and gas. So Valero Energy is number one. Western Refining is number two. Fluor, which is a construction engineering company, is three. Marathon is four. And YPF, which is the Argentinian energy company, is fifth. So sometimes I'm asked, is this a good metric for looking at energy, oil and gas companies? And when I've separated out only the oil and gas companies to find which ones perform the best, this is the best metric for looking at that, which sometimes that sounds counterintuitive. You know, perhaps you'd want to look at what their reserves are like or what their costs are like. But for one simple single metric for conducting this type of analysis, it is an enterprise value acquirer's multiple type analysis. So that's one of the things that makes me think that energy companies are going to work, because they're simply too cheap. They've just been beaten up so much. There's a lot of unhappiness with the oil price, and there's a big glut. So everybody gets really thinks that the industry is ugly and going to be dead for a while, and that's the time that you want to be buying your positions if you're going to.
So I just want to throw out there, you should have seen the smirk on Stig's face whenever Toby said that he agreed with Stig.
Yeah, well, Toby is a lot smarter than me. So, and it's really rare that people that are smarter than me agrees with me. So that's really nice. No, but I kind of expected that, because I remember the last interview we had with Toby, and he was saying that he had heard someone saying that it was only the tourists who were buying into oil. And I was thinking, that was so much fun. And Toby actually bought into oil at that point in time, and I did too. So we're two people and a lot of dumb tourists. And I guess that's that's always nice to think about.
Okay, so I want to bring up something real fast here, then Hari, we'll throw it back over to you. So I got a really interesting email from a gentleman. His name is Matt Hayon, and Matt wrote me this. He said, Preston, I noticed something and I wanted to share this with somebody. I was checking up to see where we were at with the Dondo Holding IPO, which I learned about your podcast whenever we had Hari on early on. And he said, I found this, and he sent me this link. And in the link, he wrote to me with the quotation. It says, Dondo India LTD is 100% subsidiary of a U.S.-based multinational financial service firm, Dondo Holding. Dondo Holding has recently filed a provisional patent with the United States Patent and Trademark Office, which focuses on an enhanced indexed investing model. Not quite the IPO I was looking for, but what does this mean? And so what Mom taken away from that, it kind of seems like he's doing something like with the model that Toby has talked about in his deep value book. And I'm curious, Toby, do you know Monish at all? Have you ever talked with Monish?
I've exchanged a very few words with Monish on a few occasions, because I've run into him at Value Investors Congress out here in Pasadena. He's based in Santa Monica. So we're kind of neighbors, but Santa Monica is pretty big. So I actually haven't seen him in Santa Monica. That enhanced indexing is very popular at the moment. And there are lots of patents for that sort of stuff. I don't know exactly. Is it Monish's?
Yeah, that's his.
Is it Monish's index?
That's his.
So there are lots of, you know, I think research affiliates have the first patent, and theirs is very broad. It's sort of anything that's not market capitalization weighted. So that's, you know, anything equal weight, value weight. I wonder how defensible any of those patents are going to be, but, you know, it makes sense to set up a value-based index in India and then to invest on that basis. That's a smart move, I think.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Today's episode is sponsored by Range Rover Sport. Range Rover leads by example with their dynamic design that rises to the occasion. It's got powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capabilities, coupled with signature Range Rover refinement. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable one yet, redefining sporting luxury. It's got advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, offering next level comfort and refinement. The purposeful cockpit light driving position sets the tone for a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. Award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. You can enjoy a dynamic drive and total comfort with optional 22-way adjustable, heated, and ventilated electric memory front seats with massage function. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com. Have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? A tool that not only aids you in your research and analysis process, but also allows for dynamic discussions? Today, I want to share such a tool with you called Meka. Meka is the AI-powered stock research assistant now enhanced with real-time stock data. Meka does a lot of the heavy lifting of sifting through financial statements and company data and delivers it to you nearly instantaneously, and the best part is that it's 100% free. Try it out today and ask Meka questions like, what is the financial health of Microsoft? How much cash does Copart hold on its balance sheet? What is the return on invested capital of Adobe, or millions of other prompts? Check it out today for free at Meka.com. That's Meyka.com. The Holy Grail of Investing, the new book by Tony Robbins and co-written by investing legend Christopher Zook, reveals the secrets of alternative investments like private equity, venture capital, energy, real estate, sports franchises, and more. It features exclusive insights from investing titans who collectively manage more than $500 billion, including Robert F. Smith, Vinod Khosla, Michael B. Kim, and many others. In the Holy Grail of Investing, you'll discover how to take advantage of the trillions flowing into private equity by becoming an owner of firms that actually manage the assets and share in the revenue they generate, how to take advantage of the 2 to 3 times higher returns of private credit as an alternative or complement to bonds, how to invest in the energy evolution and ride the wave of trillions in global investments, how investments in private real estate can work as an inflationary hedge and source of tax-efficient income, and how many of the world's greatest investors thrive in both good times and bad. The Holy Grail of Investing by Tony Robbins is available now wherever books are sold.
All right, back to the show.
That's really interesting. So I was just curious how much of that would have been pulled from like your acquirer's multiple. Because I know whenever I read your book, for me, that was kind of a very big transition in the way that I kind of saw the world of investing. And I was just kind of curious if he had ever contacted you, talked to you about this enterprise value, some of the metrics that you had in your book where you, I mean, if you haven't read Toby's book, Deep Value, it's a fairly transformational experience if you're a value investor. But I was just curious if he had ever reached out to you or talked to you about your book.
He hasn't, but there are lots of, you know, they're not my original ideas in that book. There are lots of people who are at the same time pursuing that opportunity. And I think it's clear that stuff does work. Which metric you choose to use, or if you use some sort of combination of the metrics, it really doesn't matter as long as you're getting some value proxy. So you could use price to earnings and you'd do perfectly fine. I think James O'Shaughnessy should get the credit there, because he brought out What Works on Wall Street in 1994, and he kind of paved the way for everybody else, and probably Joel Greenblatt with Magic Formula deserves the credit in there too. So I'm very, very late to that party. It's certainly not my idea.
You know what? You're a really modest guy, because in his book, he actually proves how his numbers are actually, 2% higher than Greenblatt's magic formula. So you're a very modest person, and I'd like to leave it at that so you don't try to undermine my comment. I'm going to throw it over to Hari. And what were you going to say before that, Hari?
I was planning to ask you all a question about oil prices. Since we are seeing a lot of fluctuation right now, what's the future of oil 10 or 20 years from now? Keeping in mind that there are a lot of technological innovation happening in the energy space, including the synthetic fuels or genetically modified algae that ExxonMobil is investing in along with another company, as well as Elon Musk's constant and persistent endeavor, I would say, to move us towards a oil-free world. What do you guys think about all that development, and how will OPEC fare in the future?
Dude, I don't know, but I've got to tell a really cool story that happened to me this morning. So my son and I went to a car show because it's Father's Day. I wanted to go out there and see some cool cars. My son loves anything mechanical. And we went there and there was a guy who had a Tesla. And that was the first time I've really kind of got up close to a Tesla car. And we walk up there and the guy who was, you know, who owned the car, the handles for like opening the door were completely flush with the door itself. And I was like, how in the world do you open this thing? Is it like fingerprint or something? And the guy says, no, he says, watch this. He walks over, he has the key in his pocket. He walks over and as he gets close to like opening the door handle like slowly emerged out of the side of the car. And then he like just pulled it open. It was the craziest thing I've ever seen. And so then I look inside this thing and the dash is like monstrous and it's just nothing but a big, large touch screen, like iPad, like looking thing. And he said, it's completely touch, like interactive dash inside this car. So your comment, I think, is I really think Silicon Valley's on the hunt to turn Detroit upside down. And I think that you have a really good comment. Like, how is technology going to just kind of revolutionize this oil industry? I don't think that I see it happening quickly, but I definitely think that you got a very strong concern and risk that you identified. So let's throw it out to the group and see what they think.
I think that the death of oil has been it's one of those things that everybody predicts 20 years hence, and it has been the case for a long period of time. You know, that peak oil idea that we just run out of oil or it gets too expensive to kind of extract. I hope that happens. I hope that we get to that stage where you have a battery at home, it draws energy off peak. So you don't pay peak prices. We sort of get smarter about distributing power. So you don't have to, you know, when it's really hot in the middle of summer, you're not drawing it at the worst time of the day, which is what makes it so expensive. So the battery power is going to, you know, time shift the way that we draw power. And hopefully that'll change the entirety of that, of several industries. And then you have a car that you can plug in at home. Solar panels on the roof. I think all that stuff would be great, and I hope it gets here really soon. But I think that it's going to take a lot longer than we think. Hopefully, it's 20 years, but I would guess longer than that.
Hmm.
Yeah, I really love when you talk about oil because I kind of feel like Preston and I, we agree on everything. I mean, literally everything when it comes to investing, comes to life in general. But when it comes to oil, I'm always much more bold than Preston, so I think that's always good fun. No, so Toby, I think that you are really hitting a spot on when we're talking about distribution. So a lot of people, they would be thinking, hey, we have other type of energy. Why don't we use that instead? That's really not how the energy market works. It isn't like you can say we can have one barrel of oil and that gives a certain amount of energy and then we can have a windmill or a hydro generator. It doesn't work like that because partly there is the distribution. You have to get the power somewhere. And then we also have a storage problem. You can't store all the type of energy the same way. And I think that's just something that that we admit from time to time. And then another thing I also want to say about oil, and you know, it's not like I don't think it would be amazing if we had an oil-free world, also better for the environment. But often when we talk about energy and when we talk about oil in particular, we talk about that in the Western world. So we are really privileged in terms of how we are consuming our energy and the technology that we have access to. Now, if you look at something like Eastern Europe or something like Russia, they use a lot of gas, they use a lot of coal. They just have a completely another type of system. They can't distribute that amount of energy because the infrastructure is so much different. And I think that's something that we might forget when we're talking about talk about oil, is that the developing world is actually using less and less of the world consumption of oil, while the developing country is using more and more. And also they don't have the same environmental issues.
So I just want to throw out there, so Stig got so frustrated with my lack of understanding with oil that he found the best book on Amazon about oil, and it's written by Morgan Downey, and the name of the book is Oil 101, and he's actually coming on our show next week for us to interview him. So if you guys have some really good questions about what your concern is with oil, send us those questions over email. And I'm talking to the mastermind group, because by the time this airs to our audience, we're going to have already interviewed him. So if you guys seriously do have some really good questions, send those over to us so we can ask him next week. And I've been pouring through his book and it's totally insane. Like, I've never thought a person could understand oil at this level, but the book is totally amazing, like unbelievable. But anyway, we'll go on to the next topic here. Stig, did you want to ask one of the questions that you had for the group?
Yeah, so we have heard a lot of smart people talking about how many stocks you need to have to diversify if you pick single stocks. So a lot of people would say you need to have like 20 stocks, because then you can calculate volatility. And if you believe in that as a risk measure, it also makes kind of sense that you have something like 20 stocks. And then you have another party who would be saying something like, well, we should just invest in index funds. And I think most people could agree on that. We can just buy like the world stock market or S&P 500 or something like that. We don't need more than one or two to be really diversified, because it's inherent in that. So I came up with that, probably not by all by myself, but I just thought, what if I did something in between? What if I invested in something like Moniz Powerwise Company, something like Berkshire Hathaway, an active managed ETF? So I would have like the diversification in terms of a lot of different stocks, but I would be heavily exposed to manager. I mean, even in a company like Berkshire Hathaway that owns a lot of different subsidiaries, you're still exposed to Warren Buffett's ability to be capital allocator. So my question to the mastermind group is, how many stocks do we need to own to diversify that managerial risk, the CEO risk, so to speak?
It's a great question, Stig. And Buffett has said that you've got basically two choices when you invest. One of them is just to buy the most diversified, lowest cost index fund that you can find. Or you invest like a value investor and you find undervalued positions and you weight towards the ones that are the most undervalued. And he says that, you know, basically the better you are at identifying those opportunities, the fewer positions you need to hold. So for Buffett, he says 5, Munger says 3. I think Pabrai would say 10, Klarman says 10. The academic literature says it depends a little bit, but it's somewhere between a 20, you've got kind of 94% of the diversification achieved, and at 30, you've got kind of 97, and then you've got these reducing returns to scale as you add more positions to the portfolio. You don't get any sort of additional benefit beyond that. The one thing that I always think about in relation to the indexes, so market capitalization weighting makes sense if what you're trying to achieve is to measure the performance of a market, but it doesn't really make sense to invest that way. And the reason is that when things get very expensive, they become an increasingly larger part of the index, and you're kind of putting more capital towards more expensive things when, all else being equal, you'd rather not do that. So the solution is therefore to either equal weight, which just gets rid of that random error, or you value weight, which is what, you know, we were talking earlier about those smart beta. That's exactly what smart beta does. So it's looking for some underlying metric. So research affiliates have a thing called the fundamental index, and they weight according to the sales or the assets, or I think they might even have number of employees. So that's another way of weighting, fundamentally weighting. But I think the best way is to value weight. So you look at a discount to valuation, and then you weight, and you need kind of a computer to do it. If you're doing it across an index of 3,000 positions or 500 positions or globally, but that's what I think they're going to do. And I think it's going to be very, very hard for active managers to beat those indexes going forward.
That was awesome. Thanks for that response, Toby. That was fantastic. I have nothing to add on that. Hari, Colin, did you guys have anything to add on that one?
I had just one comment. Like, you know, many times, like when people say risk, some of them refer to volatility and some of them to permanent loss of capital. And Stig, I'm assuming you were referring to permanent loss of capital, mm-hmm. were you?
Yeah, okay. That's correct.
Yeah, in that sense, I think, as Toby said, there are multiple ways. It all depends on your risk appetite and the kind of capital you have. For example, if you have a capital that's really long term and it's permanent in nature, as an individual investor, I can stomach volatility better than a fund manager who has to answer to his clients every other quarter. So it all depends on the situation of the investor, I believe.
Okay, so I think that's a really good point, that it really depends. And you know, I also know it's hard to come up with a number. Like, we would all like to have be able to quantify that and saying four or you need six. But let me rephrase the question differently then. Would you feel comfortable about only owning Berkshire Hathaway, for instance? So the vast majority of Warren Buffett's own net worth, that's in Berkshire Hathaway, because he says he is, you know, heavily diversified. How would you feel about that, just owning one stock? I mean, do you feel this is diversified because you have that majority risk?
So I'll tell you the way I think about it. Number one, like, you know, whenever I'm thinking about returns I can get in the market, or I should get, I kind of consider my opportunity cost and also whether I deserve it in terms of the knowledge I have accumulated, the work I have put in. So in the question is, am I comfortable owning 100% or putting my 100% of my invest in Berkshire? At this point, I would say no. And also it depends on the opportunity cost, because I'm assuming I'm not going to put everything at once. So based on what's a better alternative at that point of time, that's how I would say it. I would be interested in knowing what are your thoughts on that.
I think one of the reasons that smart beta is so attractive is that you don't have that single person standing there who can, you know, people do get old, they get dementia, they get emotional if they lose money. Some guys take big swings if they get down a lot. And you could be in a fund like Bill Miller's. So Bill Miller had a very good long-term track record, something in the order of 13 years, and then he had kind of a disastrous period. That's why I always advocate for systematic quantitative approaches to investment, because it just takes that human element out. The system always invests in a way that makes me really uncomfortable. So I think last time I was on, we were talking about oil and gas at that stage. I always feel like I have to apologize for what the system's doing, because I always think this is the time when we're going to do something really stupid. You know, and I can read like anybody else can. We can go out and see all of the people criticizing the tourists in oil and gas. And, you know, the arguments that they make are good arguments. That's why it gets so cheap. That's the bears' arguments were always really good arguments. And I can read them and agree with them because I'm sort of naturally conservative as well. But over the long term, it has been a sensible thing to invest in those undervalued things where the prospects look really bleak. And a computer will do that, where a human can make mistakes. So that's why I think that smart beta or some variation of that's going to be, it sort of solves that problem a little bit. Whether you'd necessarily put all of your investment into a single one of those indexes, that's, you know, maybe three makes more sense. So if something happens to the person running the index or there's some fraud going on, then you don't lose all of your eggs. But I think if you're in a good index and you've got a very long-term horizon, you're going to be fine.
Toby, just a follow-up question. You talked about the system. Is the only way to invest in those systems is through a manager who is following that system? Or do you have any recommendation for somebody like me, who's an individual investor who can follow that system on my own?
It's easy enough to set them up yourself. You need to be able to screen as a first step. And you know, the best books on screening are probably James O'Shaughnessy's What Works on Wall Street. And I have, you know, Quantitative Value and Deep Value, which are both sort of about screening, about valuation. And then you just need a sort of fixed handful of rules for the way that you're going to treat the portfolio, and you need to write them down at the outset. So you decide, yeah, we're going to sit down with a portfolio every quarter, and we're going to apply our handful of rules, and we're going to buy without fear or favor and sell without fear or favor. I think it's easier if you have it kind of automated, because there's always that trick that it's hard to do it. So, you know, the acquirer's multiple, just to plug that again, it does offer a pretty good, you know, pretty good screen.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/WSB. That's fundrise.com/WSB. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement. Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear, upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable. As many of you know, I love studying businesses and networking with business owners. The more I've studied businesses, the more I've realized that starting and scaling your business is easier than ever because of companies like Shopify. Did you know that Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US? Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify even helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. What I personally love about Shopify is that it's the turnkey solution to kickstart and grow your business, and they are totally committed to giving you the necessary tools to succeed as a business owner. Plus, they have an award-winning customer support team there to help you every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/WSB. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/WSB now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/WSB.
All right, back to the show.
So I just want to throw this out there. So when we look at these different approaches, I'm kind of the opinion, my investing approach has kind of morphed through the last 3 to 4 years. And I kind of side more with Toby these days than I do with the Bill Miller kind of style of individual stock picks. And just because I think it does take that emotional element out of it. And I think when you look at Ray Dalio, that's exactly what he's doing. He has a model very similar to what kind of Toby's describing here, where he's not making the picks. He has set up rules. He has programmed those rules into an algorithm, and it's making all the selections for him unemotionally. And he's doing it across a world economy. And that's the big thing with Dalio. So I got a 2-part question for the group. The first one is, in 20 years, 25 years from now, do you think Ray Dalio will be viewed as a better investor than Warren Buffett? And then the other part question, these kind of go hand in hand, maybe. What is the biggest risk that you think we face with the current market moving forward? From what I understand, Ray Dalio has suggested that the biggest risk is the junk bond market and also the emerging bond market. When you combine those two together, the emerging bond market and the junk bond market, it's accounting for about $15 trillion right now. And that's what they're kind of pinning the rose on, that this thing's ultimately going to fall in on that as being the critical variable for the next crash. Regardless of whatever psychological factor that might be the catalyst. But I'm curious to know your opinion on those two different questions as far as what's going to be the big risk that's going to make this thing fundamentally crash, and also whether you think Dalio will be viewed as a better investor than Buffett in the long term.
I'd actually have no clue about the second question. So, but the first question, I would definitely say no. And this is really a perception thing. He might get better returns, But there is just something about the art of picking individual stocks that are really hard to compete against. Even though that you have, you know, created the best beta fund ever, or even though you created the best screener ever, no, it's not something that the public would really accept as being a great investor. I think the public would say, I understand Warren Buffett, I understand the principles he's outlining, I deeply admire his ability to pick the best stocks, so that ergo that must be the best investor. Even though that we might see that a lot of people would gradually, at least in my opinion, go into this systematized way of indexing, I think that the last I still think that the vast majority would look at the art about picking individual stocks as the finest art, no matter what the returns are.
Now, see, I guess I see it a different way. I look at it, the returns being the true gauge. And I think that from my vantage point, I think Dalio protects his downside better than Buffett does. So that's maybe why I'm framing the question and asking, just to kind of get your opinion.
I think Dalio has a little bit leveraged, though, isn't he? Does he have some
leverage? He is leveraged. Absolutely, he is.
It's way too early to, Buffett, the reason why Buffett is so well regarded is because his track record is public and so long.
Yeah.
Will Dalio in 40, you know, when Dalio's 40 years into his career, he'll still be 10 years behind where Buffett is now.
Yeah.
You know, Buffett's got a 50-year public track record. It's just kind of with phenomenal returns over that period of time. But I think Stig's approach is a good one to that. Buffett will be regarded as the better investor because he doesn't hand it over to a system. He's done it himself.
He smirked again. Go ahead, Ari. I want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. So I think I agree with Stig because there is a risk that even if Dalio succeeds, as Toby just mentioned, people might credit the system. But I'm curious, how is he doing so far? Has he beaten Buffett so far?
No, I think his returns are probably around, what are they annually? 15% over, what, a 25-year period or something like that? They've been pretty good. I don't think that they're at Buffett's 19.6% or something like that over the 50 years. Or.
And what is the capital he has under management?
It's like $100 billion. It's massive.
Yeah, I think he's at $120 billion.
Okay, that's pretty huge, and 15% at that level seems quite impressive.
The thing
but
that
it's
I
quick
that,
kind of missing.
I guess the thing that I'm really impressed with is in 08-09 with Dalio, his alpha fund actually was in the green in 08. Okay, which for me that's just totally crazy, especially knowing that he has a computer algorithm making the trades. Like, I think that's totally crazy. And then is the year after that, or I'm sorry, no, in 2011, when the market was down, in 2011, when it was down, I think he'd had something like a 30 to 40% return in the green during that year. I mean, it was massive. It was just, he obliterated the market that year. So I guess I'm looking too recently on trends. And I mean, like Toby said, it's hard to go up against Buffett after he has such a long decades and decades of experience to prove that he can get a 19% return. That's really kind of hard to do that, but well, it's next to near impossible to do that except for one person. But I wanted to frame that question because I have so much respect for Ray Dalio, and I just wanted to hear what other people thought about it.
I just wanted to actually jump on the second part of your question there about risk, Preston. I recently read an article, and I'm really interested to hear what everyone else thinks of this and their thoughts on the topic, but it was called Radish's Onions and the Stupidity of Debt. And what it was talking about is the amount of margin that's being used on the New York Stock Exchange. Apparently, it crossed the $500 billion mark in April, up from something like $475 billion the month before. And I found that really interesting because that's roughly 50% higher, apparently, than it was right before the crash in 2007, 2008. So that's really interesting for me to see the amount of what is essentially just loans that people are taking and using to purchase their equity. So I just want to know what everyone else thinks when they hear those figures.
It's I think dshort.com has the charts showing the amount of margin debt relative to the market capitalization of the NYSE or whatever the index that it tracks. It's extraordinary that it's been blown so big. I don't know contextually whether that's a bigger number than it was in 2007. And there does seem to have been sort of this consistent growth over a very long period of time. There's just more and more debt in the system all the time. I don't know whether that's kind of a secular thing, that it just keeps on piling up forever and ever. And we look back in 20 years' time and say $500 billion, how quaint. You know, that's 1/10 or 1/100 of where it is now. Or whether it's one of those things that it only happens when interest rates get really, really low and you've had a very long period of time where we've had really good returns on the stock market. That's one of those things that when it cracks, it's got to be making the system more fragile, right? It makes it harder for people to hold onto their positions. If you're down, you get a margin call. Like if you're, even if you're a kind of guy who doesn't care about volatility in his own portfolio, you'll find that your broker does. You know, your broker will be asking you to make good on those positions that are down. And that's where forced selling, you know, the cascading forced selling, that's when you get the really big busts in the market. So yeah, it's a frightening thing that there's that much debt there. From my perspective, I think I'm more in the second camp where it's fragilized and it's scary.
I totally agree with Toby on that. I think that it's creating a more fragile environment. I think that it will make your downside a little bit more abrupt. He threw out a very important tip there. If you didn't hear it at the very start of what he said, dshort.com. D as in dog. Don't spell it out. Just dshort.com. Go there. I'm telling you, the charts that Doug puts up on his webpage are phenomenal. I go there all the time. I found that really interesting that you threw that out there, Toby, because we're going to the same site. Stig, I saw you had something you wanted to say.
Yeah, and I actually like to talk about that exact site because I'm such a huge geek. So I'm, you know, every month that these charts are coming out. There's 1 month lag. You know, I'm always really excited to see the development. And Toby was completely right about the trend. So we will see more and more debt as we go along. And right now it's around $500 billion. And I know that this, I mean, it's really hard to how much is that $500 billion? But I actually posted the chart on our forum and said, you know, guys, this looks really frightening in nominal numbers and almost also in relative numbers. We're looking all-time high. I don't know what's happening, but it could crash. And then one of the, Christoph, one of our great users, he's saying, well, you know, Stig, you might be right, but the market cap of S&P 500 is 20 trillion. So to me, it seems like relatively small amount of debt. And you know, I don't know what to answer him. So guys, I was really hoping for your help now that we're talking about it.
I don't think you can look at it from a market cap. I think you have to look at it in terms of maybe trading volume, the amount of trading volume per day. I could be wrong because that was just off the top of my head. But Toby, you seem to be nodding your head as well.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to know what that number means out of context. And that's kind of the point that I was making. It's hard to know whether that's a lot of money or not a lot. But the way that Doug puts those charts together on that, it certainly seems that you get these peaks in margin debt that coincide with peaks in the stock market, which makes intuitive sense. And he also seems to be suggesting that when you get the reduction in margin debt seems to precede the bust, which I find really interesting. There's not enough data points. There's only three peaks that it captures. But it seems to be that the margin debt comes off before the market comes off. I don't know how that is the case, but he has a discussion about it on his site where he talks about that.
Yeah, and I just want to throw out a quick statistic. The correlation between debt and the market is 0.97. So it's quite significant, I'd say.
So it's interesting. Colin, I think you kind of answered a little bit of the second part of my question as far as what's the biggest risk that we have moving forward and what could potentially cause the downfall. So you're saying that because there's so much leverage on the market that you think that that's setting yourself up for margin calls that are really going to have kind of this quick and immediate impact if it gets much more leveraged. Does anyone else have any other highlights or concerns that you think could be that critical variable from a fundamental standpoint, not a psychological standpoint, but a fundamental standpoint?
I feel like it's all about the easy money. And today I think there is all the incentives for people to take debt, not just in the stock market, but everywhere else. And that's, when you talked about a fundamental factor, Preston, I would identify that as one of the fundamental factor, how Fed incentivizes investors.
Hey guys, so we typically play a question from a member of our audience, but instead of doing that, what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and send Matt Hayon, who sent me that email that we were talking about with Manish Pabrai. We're going to send him a free signed copy of our book, The Warren Buffett Accounting Book. I also want to highlight the other members of our group. So Toby, he wrote this book called Deep Value. He also wrote a book called Quantitative Value, and they're fantastic books, just totally amazing if you have not read these books. Also, he has a website called theacquirersmultiple.com. That's where he has this scanner that goes through and finds the enterprise value of these different companies and that they prioritize them for you. So I highly recommend his site if you're looking to take more of this quantitative approach. Colin has a website. It's called Inbound Interactive, where he is a search engine optimization expert. I highly recommend you go there, especially if your business is more of on the private level. He has a website that specializes in that to help you get ranked within Google for those local searches. We also have Hari Ramachandra, who's an executive over at LinkedIn. He has a website. It's called bitsbusiness.com, where he writes about going to the Berkshire Hathaway shareholders meeting, to any other just business topic. I think you'll find the things that he writes about extremely interesting. So we're really just thrilled to have you in our audience. If you're really enjoying our podcast, please go to iTunes, leave us a review. That helps us out so much. We just really appreciate everything that everyone's doing out there for us. And we really hope that you got something out of our mastermind discussion today. So we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to The Investors Podcast. To listen to more shows or access to the tools discussed on the show, be sure to visit www.theinvestorspodcast.com. Submit your questions or request a guest appearance to The Investors Podcast by going to www.asktheinvestors.com. If your question is answered during the show, you will receive a free autographed copy of the Warren Buffett Accounting Book. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. This material is copyrighted by the TIP Network and must have written approval before commercial application. TIP!